In Italy during the 1970s, there was a proliferation of a number of popular crime film cycles, dealing with police investigations, the mafia, vigilantes, and serial killers. In his book, Blood in the Streets, Austin Fisher looks at these production cycles and charts how films like The Violent Professionals, Execution Squad, and Street Law tell us something about the political fallout from the Second World War and the violent political turmoil happening in Italy at the time. Austin has written extensively about Italian popular cinema, including the Spaghetti Western, and he joins me here to talk about Blood in the Streets, which won the BAFTA's Best Monograph Award in 2020. So Austin, what started your interest in this subject area?
So that's a question that goes back about 10 years, I think, because I finished my PhD in 2010, and that was on Italian Westerns and on their political coordinates and how they engaged with the countercultures of the late 60s. And I kind of thought, what next? Once I finished that, as I think everyone who's finished a PhD thinks, in a bit of a panic. And the logical answer to that was, well, what came next in the Italian film industry and Italian politics and Italian history? So I looked to the 70s, the early 70s, the onset of the era of political violence, the years of lead, and noticed that there was a proliferation of films dealing with crime in contemporary Italian locales that emerged and proliferated through the 70s. So I just became really fascinated in those. And over the last few years, I've been doing lots of conference papers on different subgenres or filoni, as they're called in Italy. So I looked at the poliziotesco, the police procedurals. I looked at the giallo, which tend to be about serial killers in some way or another. I looked at mafia films, I looked at vigilante films. And each time I gave these conference papers, I kept kind of thinking that they would be separate articles. But every time I did them, I noticed that there were trends emerging across all of them around some kind of preoccupation with history, some kind of registering of an obsession with the position of the 1970s in relation to the Second World War. And so it just occurred to me that this should be a book, that actually this isn't a separate set of discrete subgenres. This is actually something that's going on here throughout the 70s in a larger pattern of crime cinema across Italy. So that it became a book. And it was released about 2 years ago now, I think. Yeah.
Can you, I've got a small idea of it in terms of my own research and reading around it, but can you just explain to listeners what you mean by the years of lead?
So in December 1969, a bomb went off in Milan's Piazza Fontana, and this is often seen to be the starting point of this period. And anarchists were blamed and rounded up, and it became kind of it soon became apparent that they weren't the people who did it, that actually it was far right extremists who were trying to incite authoritarian rule, and they were supported by the secret services, and there was lots of cover-ups happening. And this instigated people on the far left to mobilize as well. And then there became it became a period of quite extreme political violence over up until mid to late 80s, in fact, with bombings in railway stations and kidnappings and assassinations. So it's a very violent decade, the 70s in Italy's history, and it became known as the Years of Lead or the Anni di Piombo. And it's since become a site of trauma for Italian national identity. It's something that's often represented in cinema, through literature. It's something that the Italian nation still sometimes struggles to talk about. But when it is talked about, it's about something, a kind of originary trauma for what came next. But also, I was then thinking about how it was, it didn't just come out of nowhere, like no one ever claims it did, but it was resurrecting tensions from the Second World War, latent tensions that were sort of swept under the carpet as the fascist regime was swept aside, but far right and far left antagonism remained under the surface through the 50s and the 60s, with the economic miracle, the boom in the post-war era. It was almost like things were going not back to normal, but things were becoming peaceful. Italy was transitioning to become a advanced capitalist nation. And then in the 70s, when the economic growth began to slow down, and then these extremist groups began to emerge again. So it was like a bursting through of something that was just waiting to bubble up from under the surface in the 70s. So that particular kind of fascination with the past and the haunting of the past into the present in the 70s was a really interesting context for these films suddenly emerging as well.
So the main kind of cycles that you look at are the I can never say the Polizia Cetto or whatever, the police procedural one I always go with. Cop films is what I normally describe them as. The vigilante films, the mafia films, and the gialli. Are the themes that they are dealing with, is that consistent across all of those different cycles, or are there distinctions between each of those?
So, yeah, this is kind of what I discovered in the writing of the book, was that they all deal with the past, and they all... So something I identified across these different cycles is that they all register some kind of preoccupation with the past and with the changes in Italian society since the war, but they do it in very different ways. And that only became apparent as I started to draw this book together. So the most direct engagement with the past, there's a very small group of giallo that are either set during the Second World War or are very much about the Second World War as a source of trauma. And there aren't many of them. So there's Pensione Paura, or Hotel Fear, which is set during the war. And it's all about the trauma of being bombed and kind of the uncertainties of what's going to happen in the future. But then there are films like Nelle Pieghe della Carne, which is In the Folds of the Flesh, which is a really weird kind of psychedelic giallo. But at one point, it shows a very clear black and white flashback to the Holocaust, with Jews being gassed by in Nazi gas chambers. And it kind of positions this as the reason for the trauma, the reason for the killings in the film. There are a number of films that do this. And so that's the most direct, like clear, this, like looking back at the war, thinking about that as a source of trauma. But then the other films tend to do it in very different ways. So they are set. So, for example, the Polizia Tesco is set very much in the present. It's very much about the present. It's about the bombings. It's about the terrorism of the 70s. But lurking in the background throughout all of them, and this was what really struck me, was there's a construction in all of these films of a common sense here and now from the filmmakers, because they're rapidly produced kind of serial products. They're very rapidly churned out of a production system. And so the construction of a believable mise-en-scene and a believable backdrop is quite important, especially when you're representing the contemporary locale around the cinema, the Italy in the 70s. So you need to get the audience on board to buy into the fact that this is recognisably here and now. And the ways in which the filmmakers did that, in kind of scene setting asides or in little settings, things in the backdrop that you might not notice because they're not the main point of the plots, time and time and time again, they seem to come up with these things that registered the trauma of the war, or the fact that everything goes back to political extremism in the preceding decades, or about the rapid change in Italian society, so that somehow Italy was unrecognizable from a few decades previously. And so there's this notion of cultural trauma that's sort of bubbling under the surface and then suddenly becomes apparent in these films. And it's not so much, I wasn't aiming to kind of diagnose some kind of symptomatic reading of these films. That's not really what I'm interested in. I'm not claiming that the filmmakers didn't know what they were doing or anything like that. It's more that the filmmakers had to make production decisions, very pragmatic production decisions in this particular sector of the Italian film industry, whereby they wanted to construct efficient, believable backdrops for the construction of these narratives. Therefore, in order to do that, they had to provide things that the audience would immediately connect to and recognize. And those things happened to register preoccupations with the past, which in itself is interesting, a presumption of prior knowledge on the part of the audience. And the fact that this was repeated so often as well points to the industrial conditions of the films. And that's kind of where the book led in the end. It was more about the industrial conditions than it was about the politics.
One thing that struck me about these films is the location filming, right?
And it looks kind of utterly fantastic. But it also links back to the what you were saying about where the violence was taking place, right? I mean, obviously the title of your book, the title of one of the films, Blood in the Streets, and the idea of, I mean, you mentioned there, train stations, kind of plazas, banks where the bombs were going off, where assassinations were taking place. And if you do a scan of these films, we'll mention some titles in a minute. If people go on, any listeners want to go and look at the trailers, or you will just scan through and you'll see town plazas, banks, train stations, loads of scenes set in these places where these assassinations and bombs were going off, and where the violence was taking place. Again, it gives it a kind of real immediacy.
Yes, and I think there's also, if you look at the titles of some of the films as well, Italian cities appear in many of the titles. So Roma, l'altra faccia della violenza, Napoli violenta, Torino violenta, Milano rovente. They're constantly bringing up these city names to literally, as you say, locate the audience in not just a believable here and now, but a very real here and now. So if bombs are going off in train stations, they actually were going off in train stations. And it's a very efficient way of positioning the audience in a way that they can totally buy into the verisimilitude of what's happening in the background. I think you're right. It is notable how the location shooting is central to many of these films, especially the Poliziotesco and the Vigilante films, where Italian cities and the kind of the degradation or the perceived degradation of Italian cities in the 70s by the onset of crime, of extremist crime, is central to, not always to the plots, interestingly, not always, sometimes, but always to the backdrops. It's always to the here and now. It's the essential thing that you have to just get the audience on side. You assume the audience understands what's happening because it's aimed at an Italian audience first and foremost. Differently to the spaghetti western, many of the same filmmakers came straight over from the spaghetti western to make these, whereas they tended to be more aimed at an international audience, not always, again, but, and also very clearly borrowing from a Hollywood genre, but very much not set in an Italian city and not set in the here and now, whereas these are embedded in their immediate contemporaneity. So it almost sounds contradictory for me to then say that they're obsessed with the past, but actually I think that's how they're obsessed with the past, because contemporary Italy registered so much obsession with the war and with the traumas since the war, that these films are just almost by default registering that same obsession.
I think there's also part of that as well is the, especially in the crime films, these and the vigilante films, is the presence of bystanders and how, like, the bank, not only is there a bank robbery, but they're also, they'll smash an old woman in the face while the robber. There's this, within the films, the bystanders are under threat. There's that live like a cop, die like a man. I don't know if you know that film. That's the start when there's that robbery at the start of that film, and that woman gets dragged into a lamppost. It's like there's a kind of, not only do we see these things taking place in public places, but within the films, bystanders get hurt. Right.
Yeah, and I think again it's a sign of the efficiency with which the filmmakers had to establish not just the backdrops but also the characterization. And so because Filone filmmaking was so rapid, very, very quick turnovers of production schedules. And so, you know, if you get someone to punch an old lady in the face, you immediately establish them as a villain. It's a very efficient way of doing it. And especially when the public were genuinely in danger, or they were certainly perceived to be in danger in large cities at the time. And so it's a good way, again, of getting the audience to buy into the world on screen so you can get on with telling the story. And that's kind of the key point here, I think.
What's the, to what degree were these films influenced by American trends? I'm thinking films like French Connection clearly seems to be a huge influence. With the location shooting, obviously the kind of famous car chase that takes place in the French Connection is repeated in a lot of these Italian movies, where you get really just brilliant car chases. If anyone hasn't seen these films, go and check some of them out. Death Wish, I imagine, was an influence.
Yeah.
Godfather, of course, as well. Do you have something to say about that? How did they take those American trends?
Yes, definitely, but it's it's never quite that simple with Italian filmmaking. It's kind of so with because of the rapidity of their production schedules, it makes it slightly more complex than it might at first seem. So for example, Death Wish, very influential on the vigilante strand that emerged in Italy in the year or two after Death Wish came out. But Death Wish was released in Italy the month after Enzo G. Castellari's Il Cittadino si Ribella, or Street Law, starring Franco Nero. But that film is clearly influenced by Death Wish because it had been out since July of that year in the US. So Castellari knew exactly what was coming. So it just shows how opportunistic, but how canny Italian filmmakers were, that they knew, they anticipated trends. So it's not so much that the film's influenced by Death Wish as it's a business decision that Death Wish is coming. There's going to be a big proliferation of these films. They're going to be profitable. So we better get one out quickly before Death Wish even comes here, so that we look like we were the originators of this trend. And so, and to some extent, Il Cittadino si Ribella is different to Death Wish, because it's not just a remake. It's not just influenced by it. It's a different kind of vigilante film. And so there's this, America is always very influential on Filone cinema because of the popularity of Hollywood hits and the likely profits that lie in the future once a Hollywood hit comes to Italy. But it's also, it's a little bit more complex because of the very sensible business heads that the Italian producers had. And the same is true of Godfather. So in the 18 months after Godfather arrived in Italy, about 20 mafia films came out of the Filoni system, many of which were direct rip-offs, like really, really obvious, trying to just jump on the bandwagon, inserting the word Padrino into the titles because The Godfather was released as Il Padrino in Italy. But then three of those films came out before The Godfather got to Italy. So, and again, they knew it was coming, they knew it was happening. And it's, you know, we might call it shameless, but I just call it very sensible, very attuned to public tastes, anticipating where profits will lie. So again, it's not so much about kind of unconscious biases within filmmakers or unconscious or inadvertent obsessions. It's about business decisions. It's about the industry. It's about understanding the dynamics of the transatlantic relationship in a quite an advanced way, actually, and really succeeding in anticipating profits.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about trying to center Hollywood and that anything else that comes after that or is influenced by it is somehow lesser. You know, of course, it's important to remember that within Hollywood itself, these things were influential. So that the Seven Ups comes after French Connection. There's a whole raft of vigilante films that come after Death Wish, or mafia films that come after Godfather. I mean, it happens. Cyclical trends in cinema. It's worldwide. I wonder whether there's something about also the, I may be going off on a tangent here, the worldwide impression of what New York was like at the time, because you get a lot of Italian films, even science fiction films later into the late 70s and early 80s, that are located in New York. And the Joe Fulci film New York Ripper, it's like that New York itself became a kind of site of fascination for a lot of Italian cinema in the 70s and 80s, mainly because New York, I think, probably had not necessarily linked to politics, but a similarly violent reputation at the time.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true of the mafia films. And it's what's really, I mean, when you watch The Godfather, what's really noticeable is the use of setting and the way Sicily is kind of this picturesque picture book Sicily. It's the mountains, it's the sunshine, it's the open spaces, compared very deliberately to New York, which is the kind of dark browns of the tower blocks and the skyscrapers. And that dynamic is borrowed a lot by the Italian mafia films as well. Lots of them are about the transatlantic traffic of mafiosi and about New York to Sicily and back, and kind of the New York mafia sending over fixers to the Sicilian mafia to help out, because somehow the American mafia is positioned as a kind of a representative of modernity in the way that the Sicilian mafia is seen to be much more atavistic and ancient, and therefore needs to be updated a bit by the kind of corporate model. And so you often see skyscrapers and tower blocks being framed as, again, common sense places where the mafia reside in these films. And that can be in New York or it can be in Milan, but it's not in Sicily. Sicily is still the land of Omerta and mountains and the villages?
So the spaghetti westerns were sort of dying out at this time, although, as you say, many of the directors were still making spaghetti westerns, relatively high-profile ones at this time. Chioma, for example, by Castellari, was 75. Are there aesthetic and thematic crossovers between these?
I'd say the crossovers were more, in terms of politics, certainly. The late 60s, there was a trend of political spaghetti westerns, which then died out because it was like a mini cycle within the broader genre. And then kind of in terms of political engagement, the Polizia Tesco kind of took on that mantle of the sort of more overtly politicized Fulani cinema. In terms of themes, I don't think it's so much about the thematics, because the spaghetti western it's already set in the past. It's already about the past, but it's also about the kind of the extent to which Americanization has taken hold in Italy. And so in the 70s, the spaghetti western had evolved. It had been around for so long because it kind of emerged in the early 60s. 1963 was the kind of first proliferation prior to A Fistful of Dollars. By the 70s, the spaghetti western had begun to be its own parody. And so the Trinity films came about. And so it wasn't so much referring to Hollywood or the real, in inverted commas, real world, so much as it was referring to itself by then. Because it was so influential, so iconic, it had spread around the world. And so there was still money to be made by making some spaghetti westerns every now and then. But Chioma was very much the end of it, as was Manaya, or Sergio Martino's A Man Called Blade. And they came at the end of the 70s, but they were both very elegiac, as so many westerns are elegiac. These were elegiac for the spaghetti western. These were kind of saying, this genre is now dead. So let's give it a good send-off. And so they're all full of images of death and images of traditional kind of characterizations from the spaghetti western dying. So I'd say I don't want to generalize, but I can't avoid it, because there are so many spaghetti westerns made that anything I say there will be exceptions to. But in general, the 70s spaghetti western tends to be self-referential to the spaghetti western. And so it's more a case of, well, we used to make these films, and there's still some money to be made in them, so we might as well do some, but the real money is in the crime films in the 70s. And so the same people are just, they're going from production to production. Which kind of strangely doesn't answer your question, because I don't think there is a clear answer. I think that's the point.
So how does the Giallo fit into your kind of thesis here? Because it seems to be just immediately, at first glance, it stands apart. Like, I take the point about the themes, and the obsession with the past, and particularly in The Folds of the Flesh, and it looks back to the Second World War very explicitly. But they're thought of, rightly or wrongly, as kind of horror pictures, or marketed as horror pictures, and they're more psychedelic, and they kind of have that, they hide the killer's face, right? There's a mystery to it, it's suspense, whereas the other films don't seem to be about suspense at all. Somebody robs a bank right at the start, or whether there's an assassination right at the start, we know exactly what's happening from what I've seen of these films.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the word giallo, we tend to place it in horror, as a subcategory of horror nowadays, but the word giallo in Italian really kind of more means mystery thriller. It certainly doesn't mean slasher film in the way that it does to us in the Anglophone world. It kind of just means a murder mystery, something to be solved, as you say, that we often don't discover who the killer is until the end in classic mystery film structures. So yeah, they are different. They certainly are. And I think the key thing that sort of unites them is it tends to be about some kind of serial killer, or someone stalking women at night or something like that. It tends to be that kind of thing. And so they've entered the horror pantheon in Anglophone markets, certainly, and in cult cinema markets, especially since the Video Nasties era. And they've become the really enduring crime films, if crime film we can call them. But the way in which they engage with the themes of the book, and this is one of the things that made me realise there was a book to be written here, because I didn't think that they did link originally. I kind of thought, no, they're quite separate for the reasons you've said. It comes about, I think, due to the consistent fascination throughout the giallo with, and I think I mentioned this earlier, the changes that had taken place in Italian society since the war. And so often, again, in the backdrops, though these films are very contemporary, mostly, they're very much about now, they're about jet setting, they're about the modern Italy, they're about bourgeois hedonism and enjoyment of the high life. So often in the background of these films, we see comments about or signs of something that's changed, something's happened in Italian society, something is not right. And I think the most obvious version of that is in the what I have called the rural giallo, because we often, lots of scholarship on the giallo identifies a tension between cosmopolitanism and parochialism in, and that's kind of at the heart of what the giallo is all about. It's about the transition to cosmopolitan modernity, but also about the traumatic nature of that transition and how actually lurking beneath that surface there are deeply troubling underbelly of Italian society. And that's most explicit in the ones that leave the cities and are set in the rural underbelly and kind of almost enact time travel. They kind of make the underlying theme of the of most gialli explicit, because they travel into the backwaters, and it's almost like they are literally going back in time. They kind of in Don't Torture a Duckling, for example, they bump into people on donkeys in the Sicilian countryside, or in the southern countryside. It's like they've totally left modernity behind. And so there's again a small collection, but I think these are very revealing films. So Don't Torture a Duckling, The House with the Laughing Windows, Bloodstained Shadow, Bay of Blood. These films are very much about what it means to be in a modern Italian and how that is contrasted with what Italy once was. And so when you place those all together as a large filone, they're all actually very consistent in those themes. It's just that most of them are set in the modern side of that dichotomy. And that then occurred to me that they're not doing the same thing as the Polizia Tesco, but the same themes are cropping up, the same themes of cultural trauma, of taking stock in the 70s, where kind of looking back at the war years and thinking, where have we come since then? This massive economic growth, what's happened to Italian society? And it crops up so often in these films that, again, it becomes a serial repetition. That you wouldn't point to one film as being particularly significant or really, really like politically significant in that sense. I don't think these are politically significant. But it's the repetition that does it. It's the fact that they are coming out so often in such short notice. They're coming out so often in such concentrated patterns of release in the Italian market that you just notice these serial patterns and accumulation, and a process of repetition is what happens here. So that these themes come to the fore in these filoni.
Yeah, so with that, there are a few directors here that might be more familiar, particularly to fans of kind of cult and exploitation films. So Castellari, Sergio Martino in particular, out of the ones that you kind of tend to focus on throughout the book. So to what degree is there a sense of kind of is there auteurism within this? Do you notice within this would you consider Martino, for example, to have a particular a set of themes running throughout his work, or is he a really good craftsman? Castellari, would you say is he a craftsman, or does he have kind of auteurist themes working through? Castellari, I guess he's known for using slow motion a lot during the action scenes. That's a kind of stylistic trick that he repeats, whether he's making a Western, whether he's making a war movie, whether he's making a post-apocalypse film, whether he's making a vigilante movie. Where's the place for these directors' signature moves within this repetition?
I have to say, I'm quite resistant to auteurist discourses in this kind of cinema. I think we can find them. As you say, there are things like Castellari's consistent use of slow motion. He does it in Chioma, the Western. He does it in The Big Racket, which is a Polizia Tesco. He does it in Il Cittadino Si Ribella, which is a vigilante film. So yes, there are signature things that you can identify. Umberto Lenzi as well is another one who crossed all of these different types of filone. And we could draw thematic parallels. But I'm not in the business of doing it, because really one of the key things about this book is that I've realized how much these directors were embedded in this industrial milieu. So even someone like Fernando Di Leo, who is kind of probably after Sergio Leone, the most revered auteur of Filone cinema. It's like people, there are box sets, loving box sets of his stuff that we can pore over, and huge extra interviews with people saying what a great auteur he was. And I just disagree. Because when you look at, for example, Fernando Di Leo's Mafia films, which are great films and I love them, and this is not in any way to denigrate them, because I think this is, we just need to recognize where they came from. Yes, Di Leo was a very skillful filmmaker, and I think you're right to say they're brilliant craftsmen. And I think they were, the way in which they were embedded in this industrial milieu was that they very skillfully negotiated it, and they were brilliant at doing so. And Di Leo, probably the greatest of all. But when you look at his mafia films, one thing that comes up time and time again is an elderly mafioso kind of lamenting the debasement of modern crime, modern punks who don't have any respect for the old ways of honorable crime. And it seems like a Di Leo feature. It seems like, oh, well, this is something that Di Leo does time and time and time again. Except when you look at the 23 mafia films that came out at the same time as Di Leo's films, and they all do it. Like literally every single one of them. And then you look at The Godfather and that does it too. So it's kind of, yes, Di Leo does it very skillfully. And I don't want to totally homogenize all these filmmakers, because some of them are very skillful. But if you don't look at them in their industrial context, then I think we're missing something about really what's happening in the decisions being made in the production process. And it has to be related to the Filone production model, the business model of this concentrated release around a very popular model of filmmaking. So again, it's a bit of a cop-out answer, because I'm sure there are loads of things I could say about the auteur visions of these people, and there will be loads of people who disagree with me, and that's fair enough. But for me, it's less interesting than their complete immersion in this industrial context.
I think one of the things that we take from that is that when we look at a person's body of work, the idea of the auteur vision or a particular director's vision becomes a way of marketing the movies outside of their original context, right? So it's a way of creating a box set and a narrative around one single director's work to be able to sell it to international audiences or modern audiences removed from the original context, right? It becomes a way of marketing. I suppose, you know.
Yeah. And I think that actually is something that I came to realize towards the end of this book, actually, was I looked at the cross-cultural marketing, the processes of reception in the US for these films, which is so different to in the Italian context, for very good reasons. And it is, again, it's all to do with the seriality of release patterns, and the fact that in Italy, as I've said, they were all kind of released into the market in a really concentrated pattern, kind of films trying to capitalize on a popular format before it ran out of steam. And so they were, so loads of mafia films would hit the market very, very rapidly to try and get all the money, squeeze the money out of it as quickly as possible before the trend died out. But in the US, these same films, they weren't all released in the US, but those that were came out sporadically, they came out occasionally. Certain directors became very well known, like Dario Argento, Mario Bava. So when they did come out, they were treated more like oddities. They were treated like, well, what's this? This is a really strange thing that we're not used to seeing. And they were often derided for that and mocked and seemed to be laughably bad. But they were seen to be oddities in some way. Whereas in Italy, they were marketed as part of serial repetitions. They were like one of the many of the adverts for these in Italian newspapers would say, you've seen this film, this film, this film, and this film. So now you want to see this film, as if it's a series, but they're totally unrelated. Different production companies, different directors, different characters, but they're marketed because you've seen the other films. Whereas in the US, they're marketed as kind of titillating or aberrant, kind of horrific depictions of serial killing, slashing, crime, when actually they weren't that extreme at all. But they were marketed in that sense because they were kind of one-offs. And so, yeah, the cult reception is very much due to that process of release in the US, I think.
What was their reaction to these films at the time? I'm talking about kind of the domestic critics or international critics and international audiences. Did any of these films gain particular traction outside of Italy at the time?
Again, depends what you mean by traction. If you mean critics seeing them as worthy or good, then no. They were universally mocked in Italy and outside Italy.
Even within Italy, these films were mocked.
Less in a different way. So they were derided rather than mocked. I'd say in Italy, they were derided for being irresponsible. For say, there are lots of reviews that said that, you know, the mafia is too important a subject for this kind of film to be representing. Proper filmmakers should be doing this. People like Francesco Rossi or Elio Petri or Marco Bellocchio, these kind of people who we are now familiar with make great films. Giro Pontecorvo, political films, they have something to say. These kind of hacks, these people who just work in this studio system, they should not be doing this sort of stuff. That's what the critics tended to say, which I think was just kind of missing the point, that they weren't trying to make sophisticated political points. As I've said, they were trying to make money in a market, and they were doing it very well indeed. And they were jumping on bandwagons of, you know, trends in popular taste, and they're anticipating them very skillfully. So they were seen to be kind of tiresome in the Italian market. They were seen to be, oh God, not more of this. Haven't we seen this already? Haven't we seen 10 of these, this film already, this year already? Whereas in America, they were mocked. It was laughable. They were like, what is this? They were dubbed, so that didn't help, because Anglophone markets have an aversion to dubbing in a way that Italian markets don't. They were seen to be just extreme, unnecessarily cruel or sadistic. But more often, actually, interestingly, considering how they now, especially Gialli, now have a cult following, they were more often just seen to be kind of weird more than sadistic. Most critics didn't see them as particularly violent or sadistic. Most critics just saw them as just strange and inept. And they just didn't know quite what they were watching. But I didn't come across any critics who were particularly enthusiastic about them on either side of the Atlantic. So it really is a cult thing that happened after the event that's led to them being revered in any way, really.
It's odd when you're trying to chart influences for this type of cinema. But I don't know if you've ever seen the big screen version of The Sweeney, the first Sweeney movie.
No, I haven't.
Well, watch that and see what you think. I mean, it's far removed from what you might expect it to be. But it's all about police corruption. And in terms of the shooting style of it, it reminds me very much of some of these Italian police films. But at the same time, anything that's got crash zooms and that kind of stuff happening and kind of violence from coming out of nowhere maybe just resembles that kind of international genre cinema anyway, right? Mm. And maybe it was just as influenced by French Connection and French Connection 2, I don't know. But I think it just speaks to something about there was an influence in the way that these films looked, the aesthetic influence of French Connection and Death Wish and, The Violent Professionals and Silent Action from Italy, and then even down to a big screen spin-off of a British police series, right? But yeah, I recommend checking out Sweeney. Actually, it's one of those ones where you think it's not going to be much cut, but it's really, really high quality piece of work, I think.
Nice pun there, by the way.
Yeah, not intentional. I'm not a funny man. You probably noticed that. This might be a horrible question. And if you don't have an answer to it, I'll cut it out completely. But how many violent incidents were happening in Italy? Was this a kind of monthly occurrence or weekly occurrence or daily occurrence? What was the scale of the problem of the years of lead?
This is one of these things where I need to look up the statistics in the book itself, because frankly, these things don't stick in my mind very well. But I've got the right page. It's on page 3 of the book, actually. So the Italian Ministry of the Interior recorded 14,500 politically motivated acts of violence on people or property between 1969 and 1987. And that resulted in 491 deaths and over 1,000 injuries. So that so it's a pretty sustained period of violent acts, of bombings, of kidnappings, of bank robberies, of politically, but that kind of includes everything. It's not just bombings. In fact, the bombings were quite rare. Like they happened in Bologna train station, for example, in Piazza Fontana in Milan. But it's the impression given by the high profile acts of violence is the key thing. It's the society running out of control. It's the danger that could be around the street corner, the next street corner, that's informing the backdrop of these films. And one of the things I discovered here was that looking into the how these acts of violence broke down, most of them were actually aimed at for propaganda purposes on behalf of the extreme left and the extreme right, extra parliamentary militant groups. They were trying to win people over to their cause by showing the efficacy of violence rather than killing people or destroying buildings. They were kind of doing newsworthy things like bank robberies or kidnappings. So it was a very violent time in that sense, in terms of just the sheer frequency of these acts being committed. But it certainly wasn't quite as dangerous as the films show. It was much more the news cycles. So the films are very reflective of the news cycles. They borrow the famous Hollywood gangster film trope of newspaper headlines helping to further the diegesis and narrate what's happening. And they do that because the newspapers were full of these stories. The Cronaca Nera, as they're called, the kind of the crime reporting on the front pages of the major newspapers. So yeah, it's more a case of the representation of the crimes than the crimes themselves, I'd say, is the key thing here.
Thanks. I've got two questions to ask to finish up, and these will be quite short. I don't want to panic you, but the first one's about numbers and scale again. So how many films were in these four different cycles that were produced in the 70s? Have you got a kind of, you looked at 152 films within this book?
Something like that, yeah. I lose count, frankly. But there's no easy answer to the question, unfortunately, because it really depends on how you define the boundaries of the genres. And that's always a problem in genre studies. Even when you're looking at classical Hollywood, it's a problem in genre studies. When you're looking at 60s and 70s Italy, it's almost impossible because the personnel were so fluid going from genre to genre. So for example, there's a film that I begin the book with, La Polizia Chiede Aiuto, which literally means the police need help, but it was released in the US as What Have They Done to Your Daughters? And it's impossible to tell whether it's a Polizia Tesca or a Giallo, because it's got the kind of masked serial killer trope from the Giallo, but it's got the police procedural aspect of the Polizia Tesca. It's both. It's deliberately both. It's trying to be both. And it made a lot of money because it was both. And so it's very hard to draw definitive lists of what's in what. So generally speaking, that both the Giallo and the Polizia Tesca numbered into the hundreds. That you can very confidently say that. A couple of hundred, I'd say, for both is a decent guess. Every book you read on, or every article you read on either of them has a different estimation. And so I didn't really try to do an estimation. I just sort of cited those sources really, because I was more concerned with identifying small sub-cycles within them. Because I think the problem with the word Polizia Tesca is that it encompasses police films, vigilante films, mafia films, gangster films. When we say Polizia Tesca, we tend to mean all of those. And actually, I think it's slightly more interesting to pick apart what's happening within each of the little mini cycles. So I found about 30 mafia films in a very concentrated period of time. There were others outside that period of time, but I was concerned with that specific 2-year period after The Godfather. There were I only found 4 gialli that were obsessed with the Second World War, but there are others. I found maybe 10 vigilante films. But there were others, but I was more interested in the concentration within a period of time.
And the final thing I want to ask is about what happened in the 1980s, right? So how sudden was the turn away from these cycles? And do you have a sense of what replaced them?
Yeah, so it's they kind of came to an end because TV began to take over and the whole... studio system just ceased to be as profitable as it was. So again, it's a very market-based answer. there was, broadly speaking, a bit of a cultural lag in Italy with TV, the onset of TV. Italy didn't have television until 1954. And then it became, for a good 10, 15 years after that, it was more of a kind of communal thing. It wasn't a atomizing, everyone has one in their living room sort of experience that the Western world seems to think TV as being. It was more, you would go to a cafe to watch the news, or as a community, you would join up to watch the TV. Again, this is a huge generalization, but this is a kind of, there was a slight difference in Italy to how maybe the rest of the Western world, the capitalist nations, were experiencing TV in that, certainly the early to mid 60s. So it took a while for TV to really take over and to threaten the cinema industry in the way that it did in, say, the US or the UK or France. So that was one factor. It did at last start to saturate the market in the late 70s. And then it's the kind of the VHS era, the fact that across the world, cinema started to suffer, and mass-produced cinema started to suffer in that era. And so these films, as we've discussed, they kind of entered the video nasties era. They entered the cult appreciation era. But broadly speaking, the very simple answer to why they stopped making them is they stopped making money from them. In fact, in a way, the most interesting thing is, how did they last so long? Because Filone cinema began in the late 50s with the peplum, with the kind of the classical epics. So it lasted 20 years, this very short kind of short-term business pattern where you just churn films out according to the latest fad. It's incredible it lasted that long. So it inevitably just kind of died off in the late 70s, slightly into the early 80s.
Austin, I really enjoyed that. Thanks very much.
Me too. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Austin Fisher for joining me for this episode, and thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.